Hey everybody, and welcome to another episode of Magical Musings. This is our dragon episode, and I'm Joy, and Brian is on the other end of the line. And we're going to be talking about a lot of different stuff with dragons today. So come on in, have a seat, we're going to talk about it, and hopefully this will entertain you. Okay, so... I
think first, too, that we want to kind of apologize for the lengthy delay between episodes, but life has an unusual way of altering your plans.
It does. I got evicted. I've been out on medical leave, and jobs get in the way and things like that. If you don't follow the website or our blog posts in various formats, we are changing over to a one episode a month format so that we have more time to actually synchronize our schedules, get them recorded, and get them up for you. It's still going to be 2 hours, but instead of doing it weekly or bi-weekly or whatever, it's going to be you're going to get 12 episodes a year, and that's going to be it.
It's true. Though I will say this, folks, one of the things that I'm going to say, honestly, discouraged us from doing more shows was the lack of feedback. So we do really appreciate hearing from you folks. If you listen to the show, you like it or dislike it, you know, we do want to hear about that because otherwise we don't know what's going on, if we're doing something right or wrong, or, you know, you want to hear a certain topic or what have you.
And I will tell everybody that the reason that we're doing the show again is because two people wrote us and said, I miss your show. It's wonderful. Please come back. And the reason we're doing this show, the Dragon Show, is because one of them said, I'd love to hear more about dragons. Come on. You know. So there you go. You want proof positive? You got it.
Exactly. It does help when we hear from you. Because these shows do take time, you know, depending on the topics, you know, we draw on our own research or our own experiences and,
A lot of stuff we can wing, but there's some topics that we do have to actually research. Like there's mythology that we actually need to, you know, it would be good to know what's out there and actually look up the gods and goddesses we're talking about, you know, so we have to read those and we have to make time for that, you know, so it gets to, it can be a deal. You know, but we don't mind doing it. I enjoy doing it because I love learning new things.
Yeah, for sure.
But if we don't know that you're out there listening to it and that this is something that you want to hear, then we're probably not going to continue it very long. We'll probably try this for another year, doing shows and stuff, because I figure one person out of 1,000 will write us and say, you know, we love your show, we want to hear from you. And so, you know, that one person will get more shows and make up for all of you.
It's true. That one person will have secret access to all the shows we do that never get broadcasted.
That's right. I do have one show that is on the hook right now. It's our Beltanya show. I never got it together and edited and put up. I am in the process of editing it now. I'm going to stick it up on the website probably in between shows 15 and 16. And that way it's there because that's where it would have fallen had I been doing my job. But anyway.
Well, I mean, let's be realistic, though. Life did kick us in the stomach, and you had a lot of things going on at the time. So editing and posting a show is not a priority.
True, although it should be. Although I'd love for it to be. I mean, if we could do this for a living and get supported by it, I'd do it. But
yes,
oh well. True. Yes, this is me begging for money, guys, okay?
Because let's face it. You know, there are things that cost money and, you know,
websites,
I mean,
software.
our time is of value, but, you know, we do love doing this voluntarily. We just wouldn't mind a few donations here and there
to help out. But yes. Okay. Like I said, this is the Dragon Show, as requested by one user. And we're going to be talking about a range of things. We're not only going to be talking about the dragons in popular thought currently, but some of the historical dragons and some of the ways they've been seen over time. We're not going to get into huge specifics. I mean, you know, we're not going to give you the types of dragons and, you know, what they can do and their legendary properties and stuff like that. If you want to look that up, it's a fascinating research that you can do. But I'm going to tell you right now that everything you know about dragons, you need to toss out the window and start over fresh because it all changes.
Fair enough.
You know, one of the big things that we've got that I'm at least seeing when I think about dragons is there's a lot of interest in them due to recent shows and recent movies and the recent literature that's been coming out. I mean, things like The Hobbit and How to Train Your Dragons 1 and 2, Game of Thrones, the book Aragorn. I think there's the Jousters series from Mercedes Lackey. Anne McCaffrey has dragons in her books. All of those list dragons, and there's different types of dragons in there. Generally speaking, from what I remember seeing, you've got one of two types of dragons. You've either got an extremely intelligent, articulate dragon who is arrogant as shit and out to kill everybody and get gold and eat princesses, and terrorize the kingdom, or you have mindless beasts who are little more intelligent than a snake. And honestly,
well,
go.
Yeah, actually, I mean, it brings to mind the dragons that you'd see in something like Earthsea. The book series by Ursula Le Guin or the TV miniseries that was on in the early 2000s, which was fascinating and wonderful. Because this is the intelligent, like, dragon who speaks several languages and, you know, he's basically existing to torment and confuse the little humans that, you know, think they're strong enough and, you know, wise enough to battle wits with him and so on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that repeats over and over. I mean, you got Smaug from The Hobbit, and there's, you know, a perfect example of a typical mindset for a Western dragon. He's hexapedal, which means six-limbed. He's got two arms or two forepaws, two rear legs, and then the wings. So he's got, you know, six limbs that he's got to keep control of. Really big head, huge jaw, big tail, and breathes fire. And when we think about dragons, especially Western dragons, European, Russian, American, that's typically what we see when we envision a dragon, because that's what's in the culture. That's what's been put out there. It's just, I can't really think of very many movies that have come out in the last 40 years that don't show us that. There's one, Dragon Slayer, and that had a quadrupedal dragon in it, two rear legs and two front legs that the wings were attached to. But
yes,
most everything else is the hexapedal ones. And the only thing I can think of, at least in Western, in our Western mindset, that's shown a non-winged dragon is Spirited Away.
Neverending Story comes to mind as well with Falcor.
Yes.
The Luck Dragon.
Mm-hmm. You know, and I never really thought about it until I actually saw a dragon swimming through the air. I think it was on Jake something. It's a cartoon about he's an Oriental dragon, and he's migrated to the West, and his grandfather's from American dragon, Jake Long. That's the name of it. And his grandfather's a Chinese dragon, and I saw them animating his grandfather in dragon form swimming through the air, and I went, that looks cool as shit. And, you know, because it really does. I mean, that's pretty much how they move, and it's a swimming motion, and it was really well done. Go ahead.
Sorry, I was just thinking that's, if memory serves, that's kind of the way that Falkor's flying through the air as well. And it seems to me that's a very Eastern style of movement.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, you know, you get the Western dragons who are obviously winged, and they, you know, depending on the depiction, they tend to have like either bat-like movements or, you know, like kind of, I don't know, I almost want to say wasp-type movements where they're, you know, the movement, the flight is centered around the wings, and then the body just sort of drags along and, you know, moves like with it.
Yeah. There were a couple of other things that I thought of. Discovery Channel had a special on about 6-10 years ago or something, where supposedly it was a mockumentary, except it wasn't mocking anything. It was a false one. And how, if dragons physically existed in this world, would they operate? And how would they function, and what would they do? And it was a fascinating look at them. And what those... Go ahead.
Sorry, it's actually on YouTube now, and I think it was called The Last Dragon.
Or something. I don't remember what it was, but it was... I was floored. Because it was,
yeah, I
just
thought it was great,
so
too.
Good, and the animation was really good, and the taking diverse elements from different animals that can actually do the things that supposedly dragons can do, and combining them together and physiologically working out all the problems so that they could do this. It was just a fascinating study in them.
Yeah, it really was. And I'm actually going to look that up right now because I actually stumbled across it on YouTube one day while I was searching for, I think it must have been dragons or something. And I was like, wow, I can't believe that's still around.
Once again, here we are, research and taking time to find stuff for you guys.
The Last Dragon, I'm pretty sure it was. The Last Dragon of Fantasy Made Real. It says Dragon's World, Fantasy Made Real, Myths and Legends of Dragons, fictional story of prehistoric dragons described as the story of... Sorry. Have to open that one for the rest of the details. The natural history of the most extraordinary creature that never existed, but could have existed.
And that sounds like that's it. I know I've got it on VHS tape for you kids that don't know what that is. This is from like centuries ago. It's right alongside the record there. Anyway, so So we just got Brian just sent me the URL, so that's good. I'll add it to the page when we get this up. Go ahead.
Yeah, they're discussing how they're going through animating the dragons, and they're looking at different landscapes they existed in. And sorry, I'm just kind of taking little snapshots of it while I'm going through it.
No, it's fine.
But yeah, that seems to be the one that I'm thinking of anyway.
Yeah, well, if it's not the same one, I'll find it and we'll link it up. I mean, it was a really, really good show. Let's step back a little bit, though, because there's one other type of dragon that people think of when they think of dragons, and that's the AD&D dragon. The Advanced Dungeons & Dragons fantasy game dragon, where you have certain dragons that are just evil as crap and certain dragons that are very good. They come in different colors. They have different powers, things like that. Okay, and all three of those types of dragons, the Western dragon, or the typical Western dragon, the typical Chinese dragon, and the typical AD&D dragon, all of them are wrong, but they each have elements of the truth, okay? one of the things that I thought of when I'm considering dragons is how did most of humanity come to the point where they believed dragons existed? And what I think happened was that they started with finding dinosaur bones. Because when you have a huge skull, one that's big enough to walk into, you don't think dinosaur, you think some big lizard monster that's going to eat you. And from that, you can extrapolate a dragon, especially if you don't have anything to the contrary. Okay? I think that was where most of the legends of dragons started from, is people in prehistory finding pieces of dragons, giant of dinosaurs, giant thigh bones, big rib cages, and that's where they decided the dragon started at. I can especially see it with like the Triceratops with the three horns.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, and the whole idea of them living in mountains and that sort of thing. I mean, it makes sense if you consider where fossils are generally found. But yeah, I mean, the whole notion of the whole notion of like fossils, for one, I mean, in a culture, and I'm sort of generalizing Western culture specifically, where the world was presumed to be, you know, a few thousand years old. I mean, the idea of bones and teeth and horns being found in caves or in, you know, remote locations, would probably have inspired some creative wanderers to tell tales of giant beasts that they stumbled across while they were on their journeys. And, you know, suddenly you get the amazing stories of the dragon slayers and so on.
I mean, if you want evidence of this, just look back at the historical records since the 1700s. And, you know, here there be dragons on the ocean. When it actually came about that, you know, the Leviathan from the Bible is nothing but a giant blue whale, you know, and things like that, where the natural history, you get a partial glimpse of something and misinterpret it into something fantastic when it's not necessarily so.
It's true. I mean, you look at any of the classical Greek stories about various and sundry monsters, or, you know, various mythologies around the world that talk about, I want to say it's like a Polynesian story that deals with the concept of the devil fish or something, and they're referring to an octopus as being this terrible beast and this sort of thing. You know, when you don't fully understand the world that you're living in, it becomes very easy to invent fabulous stories based on the things that you stumble across in nature.
The hammerhead shark, the platypus, the jackalope. I mean, the jackalope is actually fictional, but the hammerhead shark, who would make a shark that has eyes on opposite sides of this big, long, bony protrusion thing, where they can't see anything in front of them? I mean, what kind of benevolent deity does that? It's
true.
So things like that actually do happen. When they actually found the platypus and started investigating it taxonomically, the people that were looking at it thought that it was a taxidermist's joke, like the jackalope was. When they actually found a real live living one, it was like this revolutionary thing. But then again, you've got, you know, simple, the narwhal. You know, here's a whale, and we're going to put a long, long, long spiraling horn on his head. And then we're going to get, the manatee. And it's going to make it sounds and, oh, that's actually the sirens and the mermaids that are calling everybody to their death. You know, and it's like, what? Where did this shit come from? Well, it comes from fantastical imagination.
It's very true.
You know. So that's
human imagination, a little liquor and stuff.
fear and good stories after the fact.
Exactly. I mean, I saw a fat gray beast swimming slowly across the water. Not much of a story. On the other hand, if you've heard the song of a beautiful woman calling to you from the beach, suddenly, hey, it's not a manatee or a sea cow, it's a mermaid.
So I think that's probably the genesis of a lot of this. But that doesn't mean that it doesn't exist, because there have always been people who were able to see more than just the physical, okay, and able to get into the astral, able to get into other worlds where some of these beasts and some of these creatures exist. What I'm going to say here, here's the disclaimer. The entire rest of the show, all hour and 40 minutes of it, is going to be a lot of speculation, okay? A lot of it is due to what I have personally experienced while on the astral. A lot of it has been confirmed by others. A lot of it has been talked about in various forms and such. But if you don't start with the acceptance that there are worlds beyond this one, it's all going to seem really fantastic and like I'm making it all up. Okay? So you kind of have to suspend disbelief here.
Well, and actually that's something that, like, a lot of authors on shamanism refer to, like, the difference between what is his name again?
Carlos.
The dude that everyone knows.
Castaneda's?
Not Castaneda, Michael Harner.
Okay.
He defines the two states of consciousness as ordinary state, you know, as the ordinary state of consciousness versus the shamanic state. Mm-hmm. And if you talk to people who have experienced shamanic consciousness, then the things that you say are going to sound completely normal, because it's understood that those realities exist simultaneously. So speaking in the sense that, you know, dragons exist and, you know, mermaids exist and fairies and, you know, so on and so forth, someone who understands the simultaneous veracity of those realities is going to be completely okay with that, and it's not going to sound weird.
Which dovetails with a lot of stuff that I've run into, where you have a consciousness that exists on the astral plane, but human need to categorize and to label everything forces that consciousness into a shape. And that shape is defined by what our expectations are. I can't tell you the number of times that I have been doing a talking to or associating with some consciousness on the astral and come to find out that I think it's one thing and it's actually something else, because my own experiences have pushed it into a mold that I'm comfortable with. For instance, and this is going to sound really freaky, a lot of the deities that we consider to be gods in human form are actually dragons, or a lot of dragons are actually deities. Okay, it goes both ways. For example, there's a Shinto belief in Japan. Shinto is defined literally as the way of the spirits. It is worship of the kami. It starts with the belief in animism, which means everything that exists has an animus or a spirit, and that in order to live your life cooperatively, you acknowledge that spirit, you are grateful to that spirit, and you do your very best to either not offend that spirit or to make restitution to that spirit should something happen. Okay, that is the basis of Shinto. One of the main kami in Shinto is Fujisan, the mountain. Okay, everybody sees the mountain, and it's a huge mountain. It's got a base of 78 square miles at the very base of the mountain. It stands there like, you know, it's not part of a chain of anything, but it's also an active volcano. In fact, it's three active volcanoes. But you can see it, and it's, you know, this huge thing that people can associate with, okay? And so naturally the human animus believing part is going to go, oh, well, that's some god, and start worshiping it as such, okay? When I started working in with the dragons in Japan, with the spirits there on the astral, okay? Always depend on the astral. One of the first things that I met was Fuji, the dragon. And, you know, here's a huge spirit that laid down and let a mountain grow up around him. And it became Fuji the mountain, okay? But here you have people worshiping a spirit as a god who is actually a dragon, and vice versa, okay? The god spirit of Fuji is a dragon. A dragon is the god spirit. Okay, so it goes both ways. And that's just one example. This has happened over and over and over again to me, and it's shook concepts in my head every single time. It's happened with the Morrigan. When I started dealing with dragons, I started meeting a whole community of them. It seemed like there were regional rulers to different areas of the planet. Fuji was in Japan and a lot of the islands there. There's several dragons in China. There's a couple in Russia. There's several in Europe. The one with England and the Celtic eyes was the Morrigan, who turns out to be a really powerful dragon. Well, then I started thinking about, well, how would she be, you know, a deity or a dragon? And then I started seeing that the Morrigan's name means great queen. Well, so does Rhiannon. Rhiannon. That also means great queen. Then you have Eriannhrod, who is the goddess of death and the moon behind the north wind. So you start seeing associations between different deities that come together. Danu and Tuatha De Danann as well. And if you start considering that one spirit, let's call this female dragon, whatever, could be appearing to different people as the same person, and they're associating her with different things, telling stories about her, creating legends, sharing those legends over the campfires, and perpetuating it until they start becoming different people completely. Okay? And so now you have one central spirit that is all of that combined, but with aspects in different areas that are different deities. Does that make sense?
Sure.
You sound confused.
I might be, but I'm hoping that our listeners aren't.
Okay, well, I mean, it's like if you had Lou. Lou Samaldanich in Ireland. And then you have Lou Lough Yiffy's Welsh deity. And then you have Lug, the god of light, in the Gaelic areas in Europe. They've been traced to all the same deity type, just different subregions and different aspects of those subregions. And then if you take that powerful spirit, the draconic spirit, and you start worshiping it and those different aspects, you now have one spirit who is taking care of multiple different areas, okay? And this has been shown anthropologically. I mean, Robert Graves tried to do it, and really made a mess of it with the White Goddess. But it's been shown over and over and over that different names for the same deity type. I think Joseph Campbell did a lot better job connecting them so that you have different archetypes and different spirits that are working in those archetypes. So it doesn't matter if you call them a dragon, if you call them a god. It really doesn't matter to them. What matters is how you associate with them, okay?
Yeah, for sure.
You know, another prime example is, here's a deity down in South America, Quetzalcoatl, okay? He is the chief deity of the Aztecs. He was a high-up deity of the Mayans and the Incas. And his name translated to feathered serpent. Okay, well, what is a serpent with feathers? A dragon. I mean, once you make that connection, you go, okay, now I understand how he can be, how a deity can be a dragon and a dragon can be a deity at the same time.
It's true. Although, you know, if you're watching Ancient Aliens, I mean, Quetzalcoatl's a spaceship or something. I'm not actually sure anymore. I stopped watching the show. But, yeah, I mean, it makes sense that different regions are going to, you know, even if they have similar names for a deity and similar aspects to said deity, they're going to worship it in the way that makes sense for their own culture. You get the same idea with, I mean, under the blanket heading of the horned god as well. You know, like different regions have different horned gods, mm-hmm. who are, generally speaking, dealing with, you know, virility and fertility and, you know, most often something to do with, you know, the phallus and the male, like, rutting animals and that sort of thing. So it's, you know, it does make sense that different regions are going to name and praise deities in their own certain ways. I mean, even when you look at deities according to, like, the concept of primal powers in nature, I mean, gods of thunder or, you know, what have you, it's generally easy to relate, you know, one type of god to, you know, various cultures, because every culture faces the reality of lightning and fire and, you know, light and darkness and mm-hmm. death and so on.
Mm-hmm. And, it, you know, it's very easy to do. And when you get a shaman or a holy person or a spey wife or somebody who says that they've met and talked to fill-in-the-blank spirit, you know, yeah, you're going to start listening to them, and that's going to create more of a belief and everything like that. But we've talked about all of this with the deities in other shows, and if you want to go back and listen to them, please do. We'll probably keep discussing them at various times, but right now, let's get back on topic with dragons. Anyway, my fault for the huge divergence there, but
it all relates to tarot, never mind.
Okay, so anyway, we got various cultures calling various creatures that they perceive as dragons. And one of the things that can happen, and I think a lot of the reason that there's confusion between dragons and deities, is because dragons are anthropomorphic, okay? I hope I'm using that word right. If not, I'm sure somebody's going to yell at me. Which means they can shape change. Okay, so it matters entirely upon how they want to be perceived and how you're perceiving them. Polymorphic. Okay. They can be human if they want. They can be a dragon if they want. They can be a deer if they want. It all depends on what is going to work for them. And since shape on the astral plane is a matter of belief and a matter of common choice, you know, it becomes really confusing really flippin' fast. How do you know you're talking to a talking lizard or a person or a goat? When all three are capable of talking to you, having an intelligent conversation with you, and swapping around and back and forth, and changing right in front of your face. You know, it's one of those cases of, duh. So, it really comes down to what you decide what you want. Go.
Well, no, I mean, I was choking as you said that.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Sorry, I was drinking coffee at the same time. But yeah, I mean, reality is that, you know, as you work with different spirits and deities, they're going to sort of basically personalize their appearance to suit you. So it doesn't really surprise anyone that, you know, a particular animal spirit or, you know, dragon or what have you is going to show itself in the way that suits you best. You know, whether that is to sort of draw on fear or to, you know, draw on your personal aesthetic or what have you. I mean, it's going to relate its best to suit you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I don't know, the one of the things that I find really interesting when I get on various chat boards and start actually talking about this is that there's this pervasive thought amongst people who think about dragons and deal with dragons that dragons have our best interest at heart. And I can tell you for a fact that unless there is a direct need for us to contribute something to them, dragons could care less if we disappeared. Okay? When you have a lifespan that measures in eons, literally, thinking about a human being who's only going to be alive for 60 years is, I mean, that's a flash in the pan. That's the lifespan of a mayfly. You know, yes, it's here right now and it's bothering me, but then it's going to be gone tomorrow and it's going to show very little effect on the rest of the universe because it was here. Okay. However, you get 20 or you get 7 billion of them together, and that's going to cause a lot of change really quickly. And in discussions with various dragons and such, I've found out that the reason that they're not here on the planet anymore is because we just crowded them out. Humanity, we were able to coexist with them several hundred thousand years ago, but as we got more technologically advanced, as we got more capable of hunting, the places that they had to go and the places that they had to be and just be themselves and the territories they could claim, just we were a virus, literally, and we crowded them out. And the decision was made that instead of wiping out something that could potentially cause changes ecologically, that they would just remove themselves from the planet. Okay, and go back to the astral realms. And when you stop and think about it, we're seeing the same cycle with humanity and viruses and insects. I mean, the insects have an extremely short life, and they're gone. But we can't wipe out all of the mosquitoes, for instance, or even better, the bees, because that would, you know, be detrimental to us as a species and the planet. You know, yes, over 100,000 years, they could, ecologically speaking, nature could fill that gap with something else, but that's not going to help us today. It's not going to help us in a year. It's not going to help us in 10 years. And by the time it fills
that... It's
very true. If it, by the time nature filled that ecological gap, if we wiped out all the honeybees, we'd be gone. So, you know, that's kind of the attitude that I got with the dragons when I first started working with them. That human beings were essentially insects, and we had about as much impact on them as insects would have, but they couldn't just wholesale wipe us out. Okay, so that's one of the pervasive attitudes, and one of the things that a lot of people who think about dragons, and I don't know, I want to say a couple of very cutting remarks, but I'm not going to, because we're going to try to be politic here. A lot of the people that deal with the other worlds and deal with dragons directly have seen, and what they have communicated with, to me at least, and what I've read. The cutting remarks that I want to make, I'm going to put this out here, and we're going to move on, okay, because it's something that I've seen over and over and over, and that is the dragonkin, the furries. Those that feel that they are related to dragons, or that they are, reincarnated dragons in human form. Okay, I'm not going to say that they're right or not. Okay, because that's what they believe, and if they sincerely believe it, then who am I to say that it's wrong? What I am going to say is that I have been told by a number of dragons that currently there are only about 5 people walking around on the earth who actually are related to dragons. Dragon kin, literally. And they've all been adopted, and they've all become very involved in dragon affairs, and had a lot of change on that stuff. Somebody saying that, you know, they're dragon kin themselves, I would probably take it with a grain of salt, except if they had an extensive amount of knowledge and a lot of information about the dragons, and their society and how things go about doing everything. That doesn't sound arrogant at all, does it? No, not at all.
Why? No. It doesn't sound that way at all.
I'm probably going to have to cut that.
But, I mean,
out.
At the same time, too, you know what? I would leave it in only because I think one of the things that concerns me with sort of society today in general, and I am slightly veering off topic, but is the fact that people want to be offended by everything. Mm. You know, you say something in passing and people will be like, wait a minute. That's completely hateful, and I can't believe you think that way, et cetera, et cetera. And it's like, you know what? I made a passing remark. Oh, God, yes. Ah, Tumblr. What
yes.
will you think of next? But seriously, I mean, like, the reality is people can choose to be offended or not, but, you know, it's not up to you to police my thoughts and my vocabulary,
right,
just because it slightly tweaks your, you know, particular view of the world or whatever.
I'm not gonna,
so
like
I think
said,
personally,
yeah, like I said, I'm not gonna say anybody else is wrong about it. I'm simply gonna state that I've been working directly with dragons for a decade now, and there's a lot that can be said for them. There's a lot more that needs to be corrected, and a lot of work that that humans need to do to fix things, okay? Yes, I have been adopted by Fuji-sama. He and his son, actually. He directed his son to adopt me straight into the clan so that Fuji actually became literally my grandfather. And then Fuji himself readopted me so that I was his son. What does this mean? It means Jack. It means that I get a lot of grief and a lot of problems and a lot of people coming at me for no particular reason other than they want to give me a problem. My daughter just sent me a note here. It says, "I'm quarter Kitsune, quarter Tengu, quarter Dragon, quarter Rock, and you just offended my non-binary soul." And puffing her chest out. And it is funny because a lot of people are like that. You know, they
It's true. I mean,
they have such a need to be special that they wind up being ridiculous instead. You know, I try really hard, really, really hard to not claim anything that I don't feel that I've earned. For a long time, I refused to call myself a priestess or a priest because I didn't feel like I was. I was Wiccan, but I didn't feel like I was somebody that, you know, ran the rites and did the things that the clergy would do. And somebody else said, "Well, this is a priest of, you know, Hearn," and I went, "Whoa, that's wow. Yeah, that is what I am, isn't it?" Because when I stopped and thought about it for a second and started looking at all the things that I do, that's exactly what the clergy does. And I was doing all of it, so I might as well take the title on. But anyway, okay. So a lot of this information comes from directly working with the various dragons and and the social network of the dragons.
Dragon Facebook.
Oh gosh. All right, so we've got all these dragons that are around and that show up in various stories. One of the other dragons that people probably don't realize is a dragon is the Midgard Serpent. And I mean, here you have a worm that was thrown into the sea by divinity, Odin, that grew to encircle the earth and is constantly eating itself. Okay, the Ouroboros. And when you look at the ideas and the stories, I don't really see how you can say that the Midgard Serpent isn't a dragon, especially given how much dragon iconography is in Norse mythology. You know, you've got all these different worms and different dragons. They may not call it a dragon, but it's a dragon. And they're there, you know. So might as well call a spade a spade.
Well, okay. And two of the ones that come up or that come to mind in sort of the Western culture and kind of Northern European generally are the tale of Siegfried and the Dragon.
Mm-hmm.
That you'll find in the Volsung Saga or in the Nibelungenlied. Both are the same story retold for Germanic and Norse regions. And then the story, of St. George and the Dragon.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they're the same kind of story, and I'm kind of certain that St. George is actually kind of a knockoff of the other story, just because of the similarities. But, you know, and then of course you get the sort of influence of Christianity that says, you know, Satan is a dragon and, you know, mm-hmm. it's like, well, yes. I mean, we are clearly fond of our dragons and they exist everywhere because dragons are a powerful and scary concept mm-hmm. to work with and
yeah.
to use as a moral defender.
I think part of it is that it is a fourth type of intelligence. There was somebody, I can't remember exactly who it was, but they defined four different types of being. There is the less than human, the animals who live in the now and just have instinct. There is the human intelligence, like us. There is the greater than human intelligence, like deities, Yahweh. And then there's the other than human intelligence, like AI and alien intelligences. And dragons fall into the fourth category of intelligence. They are other than human. They're just as intelligent as people. They are just as diverse as people as well. Okay, they're just as foreign as an alien thought pattern. Okay, because they have their own needs and their own wants and their own desires, and they're thinking on a level that we can barely conceive of. I mean, they're thinking in patterns of hundreds of thousands of years. I don't know about you, but I'm not thinking of 10,000 years from now when I plant a seed in the ground. I'm thinking of dinner in, you know, several weeks. And I'm not thinking about the oak tree that's, you know, 60 feet around when I put the acorn in. You know, it's wood for next year or the year after or something like that. You know, I may think 5 years down the road, but not 100,000 years down the road. Dragons, to them, 1,000 years is a day. And that's, you know, their normal day, and they're sleeping part of it, and they're up part of it, and they're doing things during that 1,000-year time period. So when you think about it, you know, we're just a couple of minutes in their life. So they've got an entirely alien set of priorities because they're dealing with such a long time span. And I actually found something out when I was working with Fuji at one point. They're not seeing time linearly. Okay? They're seeing it a lot like a Time Lord would. There was an episode of Doctor Who where he's talking about how it's a big ball of wibbly-wobbly, timey-wimey stuff. Okay? And when you actually do pull back from the linear viewpoint, it's pretty much what it is. When you can get to the astral plane, one of my great analogies is the tapestry of time. Okay, imagine your lifetime as you're in the middle of it. You see a beginning and you see an end. You see all the flaws. You see all the things that you did wrong. Okay, now get a tapestry and pull in very close with a microscope onto one thread or one section of a thread. Okay, when you're focused that tightly, you can see all of the flaws, you can see all the problems, you can see how many fibers combine to make that thread, you can see where they've broken and they're sticking out, you can see the different colors and stuff. Okay, and that's all you can see. But when you take that away and you pull way back, instead of just seeing that tiny little piece of it, you now see this entire tapestry, and you've got the entire panorama of what is depicted upon this tapestry. And it doesn't matter that there's a couple of fibers that are broken in that one little place. It's the overall sum of that tapestry. Okay, that's pretty much how time is. When we get into a linear thought, when we incarnate, we're pulled in with a microscope, and we can see everything in terrifically good detail. But it's not until after we get out of that incarnation and pull way back that we can see the entire big picture, which is literally what it is. That's how dragons see time all the time. All right. One of the things that was really profound when I read it in Jonathan Livingston Seagull is if all times are here, or if all times are now and all places are here, then putting up artificial boundaries between us of later and over there destroys the very brotherhood we're trying to achieve. Okay. All times are now. All places are here. So don't you think that we're going to see each other somewhere around here and now? I mean, that's, you know, because it's all at one point, but you can see how it all fits together. And it was a hell of a revelation when this hit. And I realized that, yeah, this is how a lot of the beings on the astral plane see time and see existence. They're not seeing minute by minute. They're not seeing hour by hour. They're seeing by all of it, all at once. And so they know that they can manipulate this piece here and have something over there in a later time, in a later place, change because of that little manipulation. Okay? So really ancient dragons just sort of sit around and not do much of anything because they know they can really mess things up if they start manipulating too much of it. Younger ones, of course, don't. One of the big things that shocked me when I actually started getting involved with dragons is they're ruthless as hell. And they're not ruthless in their relations with us. They're ruthless in relations to each other. There were some dragons that I knew that were fairly young, and who decided for some strange reason that they were going to fight each other. One of them had defended the other, and they were going to fight. And it was a fight to the death. And one of them died, the other didn't. And I was like, wow, this is horrible. I mean, because here's a living being, a thinking being, one that has emotions, one that has sympathies, has a mother and a father, has sisters and brothers that are going to miss it, who just died, you know. And I was mourning. And several other dragons are like, what are you mourning for? And I'm like, because he died. You know, every man's death affects me. I am not an island. And they were like, well, that's a nice sentiment, but he was stupid. He didn't deserve to live. And I'm like, what? And they were like, look, both of these dragons were dumb. One knew that he was being wrong. The other knew that it was stupid to do this. They just proved it by having this fight and one of them dying. That dragon that's dead is no longer part of the gene pool. That dragon that's dead will no longer be able to pass on his genes and his personality and his learning and his understanding to anybody because he's dead. And that's good because it strengthens everything else. And I went, whoa. And it was like, okay, so they've got an entirely different mindset here. They've got the survival, a real Darwinist mindset. Survival of the fittest, the smartest, the greatest, the best. Not the sports. Not the ones that are injured. Not the ones that are damaged. Okay, those need to be destroyed and gotten rid of. And it was like, whew. And it was a hell of a revelation to me. You know, because you don't, when you think about dragons, you don't really think about it that way. Most people, when they think of dragons, see, you know, Toothless from How to Train Your Dragon. A obviously intelligent being that maybe can or can't talk, but who is a partner to somebody else and capable of doing a lot of damage, but has the capability to love a human. Okay, and unless it's a very, very strange dragon, they're not going to love you like an equal. They're not going to love you like a brother or sister or a friend. They're going to love you like a pet, maybe, if you're lucky, unless they see something really different in you. Most dragons, in fact, are going to be really arrogant about it, and they're going to see themselves as superior to everything. It's one of the biggest problems that I've had in socializing and working with dragons is that I'm constantly discounted when I come up with something because I'm human and I don't know. What they seem to forget is that humanity may be confined to this fleshy body that we've got, and we may have a lifespan of 80 years, and there may be 7 billion of us on this planet, but that existence is not all that there is. And eventually those 7 billion people are going to shed their flesh and shed the spirit of what they've come to understand during their lifetime, and they're going to be the souls that are now inhabiting the astral plane. And they're going to have to deal with them then. So, you know, it's
true.
It's, I don't know. It's big digression there. So yes, dragons are arrogant to a fault. Some dragons are a lot more long-seeing than others and actually realize some of that, like Fuji, like the Modigan, like Quetzalcoatl. I can tell you that dragons still do exist on this planet. We're just not able to associate with them directly, because most of the dragons that are still physically here are doing things like Fuji did. They're becoming mountains. They're becoming a mountain range. They're a current in the ocean. And that's where they swim at. They're clouds in the sky. And that's how you see the dragons and see their physical forms these days. You're not going to see a lizard thing coming at you unless you go to Komodo, and then you're probably going to be munched on. But you'll see, you know, Mount Rainier. You'll see one of the earthquake off the coast of Japan that caused Fukushima to melt down was caused by a dragon who decided that he was going to roll over and did so and caused an earthquake, which caused a tidal wave, which destroyed Fukushima and all the resulting problems. Another problem was, or another thing similar to that, was there was an earthquake in northern China, I believe, that killed something like 68,000 people about a year before Fukushima. And I know exactly what caused it. I happened to be fighting with another dragon and wound up killing it. And that dragon's mother got upset. Because here's what happened. I was fighting. I defeated it. Everything was okay. And the very next day, the earthquake hit. And that's a hell of a coincidence, especially when you're talking about a regional ruler in China who happened to be the mother of the dragon that I killed. She was mad, you know. Just like you'd be mad if a mosquito killed your child. Say the mosquito had malaria. Bit your child. Child dies from malaria. You're going to be upset, aren't you? You're going to want to get rid of all the mosquitoes. Well, she was pissed. And she wanted to get rid of me. And boy, did she try, too. Anyway. Okay. So that's where we're at right now. And that's a lot of, I don't know, I'm losing my train of thought badly here. They do take the forms of mountains, clouds, currents, things like that, volcanoes. One thing that I've come to understand is that all dragons are all things and not just one or two. Okay. Yes, you have fire breathing dragons. Okay. But not every dragon breathes fire. Most do. A lot will. Some will just eat you. Some actually have gaze weapons where they look at you and you go to stone. I know one small earth dragon who gets startled and breathes on you and you turn into a rock. Surprised the hell out of him the first time he did it, too. And I used one of his statues as a paperweight. He got surprised by a rat. He breathed on it, and it turned into a statue of a rock or a rat. So I picked it up, put it on my desk.
Nice.
It's kind of interesting, though. But they can be, if they want to breathe fire, they can. If they want to petrify things, they can. If they want to have a gas weapon where they breathe chlorine gas and you keel over dead, they can. They also are not one sex or the other. they can choose to manifest most of the time as one sex or the other, but most times they'll just be no sex or they'll be both sexes. They're real gender fluid. And it depends on how they're feeling, too. I mean, we've got aspects of various feelings that we attribute to either male feelings or female feelings. You know, nurturing, taking care of, helping, that tends to be female. Aggressive, angry, domineering, destructive, that tends to be male. And it's the yin and yang dichotomy. If a dragon is feeling, you know, very possessive and very going to take care of you, then they may, you know, show up this time as female. And next time, if they're mad at something, they may show up as male. You know, it all depends on how they're feeling that day. Most generally tend to decide to be one sex or the other, and that sort of determines the rest of their existence. They also tend to pick one or two, or possibly even three, primal elements to deal with. And to manifest, be it fire, earth, air, water, void, wood, ice, metal, whatever the elemental structure that you use is, there's going to be a dragon that aspects that, and you can deal with that dragon that does that. A lot of people have theorized that the guardians of the watchtowers are actually the dragons that are in charge of that particular element. Some have also said that a lot of the archangels are dragons, and they just show up as male with wings and flaming swords or whatever. Okay, so that's, you know, it's however you want to perceive them, and they'll probably be perceived that way. Okay.
Well, and I suppose that, like, there are shows nowadays. I want to say it's Supernatural that comes to mind, where dragons are actually showing up in human form because it's just easier to get around in human society that way. Mm-hmm. As opposed to, you know, being a giant lizard beast with wings that, you know, has to tromp through human society and try to be inconspicuous.
Yeah, and that's, you know, part of it is, you know, if they want to interact with us, they're going to interact with us, and they're going to work to fit in so that we don't realize that they're other than human. Because I'll tell you something, we've got a lousy track record with other than human intelligences. We as a society, as humans, tend to destroy anything that we don't understand. I mean, just look at all the movies like War of the Worlds, where an alien comes down and does it coexist peacefully with us? No. What does it do? It attacks us because we said it attacks us. Why does it attack us? Who knows? And we wind up killing it. You know, ID4. Like I said, War of the Worlds, The Day the Earth Stood Still, you know, any of the classic movies like that, Them, The Blob. We got this really bad track record of killing intelligences that we don't understand. Dolphins and whales.
And as it's true. I mean, but I mean, in all the movies that you listed, it tends to be the American military that tends to be the enthusiastic party in the destructive process.
Well, if I knew samples from Japanese or Chinese cinema, I'd use those. I'm sure they've got them.
I'm sure they must. Every culture has something dealing with destroying things. I'm trying to think of the Asian vampire movies that I've occasionally seen. Can't think of any offhand. But, yeah, I mean, generally, humans are kind of prone to destroying things they don't understand. You know, take a look at, like, the Inquisition as an example. Take a look at the Cathar, you know, annihilation. I mean, like, this is just the way of human beings. We are a simplistic and destructive race.
Mm-hmm. Star Trek. I mean, you want a perfect example of it? Star Trek, the original series, with William Shatner and Spock, and you get that entire theme throughout the entire three seasons. Humanity trying to destroy other intelligences. And the other intelligences mostly going, well, fuck you, you're idiots, we're leaving. And you're not mature enough.
Well, isn't that the whole point of the Prime Directive of the Federation? Like, to interact and learn but not interfere?
Yeah,
or something like that.
But do you know how many times they broke that throughout the three seasons, and then all the other Star Trek shows? I mean, they broke that practically every episode. I mean, Schrodinger. Simply by watching something, you're affecting the outcome.
Yes.
That's kind of what
came to mind when you were discussing the way in which dragons appear to people. I mean, the whole concept of time and the nature of reality is based on the idea that without an observer, things don't happen.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, only one thing happens because it's been observed, whereas, you know, every reality and possibility exists simultaneously unless there is an observer or some recording device that changes that.
Mm-hmm.
Now we get into quantum physics and dragons and...
Hey, look, quantum physics is part and parcel of the occult. The Rosicrucians and the Golden Dawn and John Dee and all of those were teaching quantum physics before the idea was even come up with, because that's exactly what's going on. I mean, what they taught is what quantum physics is showing now and proving now. I've heard tale of a particle called the imagon, which can make reality around it. It can force the observer to see a particular setting and to exist in that setting. Well, when you stop talking about the physical, what is the house you're sitting in? It's nothing but perceived walls that you can now move through if you don't have a body. You know, so...
Well, and then you get into the whole discussion of, like, spirits and ghosts and, you know, traveling through solid objects. And we are a strangely narrow-minded species as well.
Personally,
That can't possibly be real.
Well, personally, my take on the whole thing is that everything exists. Everything is intelligent. Honor that intelligence. Don't worry about the form. Don't worry about what it's doing to you, because you can decide what bothers you and what doesn't. And, you know, don't pee in the pool. It's really simple. You know, be nice. Be nice to each other. Don't go out of your way to make trouble for other intelligences simply because you can or simply because you don't understand them. I mean, when you start doing that, you start making enemies, and those enemies will come back at you, and those enemies can, in time, kill you and hurt you. Did you ever stop to think that maybe the whole reason that your life is shit is because you were rude to some spirit someplace? I mean, when you start thinking about that, the idea of animism and Shinto really starts making sense. Not necessarily appeasing the spirits and stuff, but at least saying thank you. Thank you, spirit of the light bulb, for working this time and letting me see. I appreciate it. You know, thank you, car, you know, for running and not braking on me and not blowing a gasket, you know.
Well, and that brings to mind the whole concept of, like, even examples that you would find in modern movies like Avatar, where, you know, or in like Dances with Wolves, I want to say, but I can't really think of the example from there. But, you know, where the hunter kills something, but then, you know, offers basically a ceremony or a prayer of thanks saying, you know, I'm sorry that I had to take your life, but your life will preserve mine, kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And you get that all over, like, Aboriginal cultures from anywhere in the world.
It's simple respect.
And it... Well, yes, because, I mean, the reality is that the closer you live to nature and kind of the rules that govern it, I mean, the more you recognize your complete dependence on that system to maintain your own life. And I think that Western society, by living in this illusion of supremacy, has completely taken itself away from the reality. And, you know, this is kind of where our culture is heading, where, you know, we've lived so long with this illusion of superiority that we've forgotten our absolute dependence on the rules of nature that say, well, no, you're just, you know, you're the same as any other creature. Mm-hmm. So you should probably, like, stop doing that.
And I'll tell you something. If humanity died out en masse tomorrow and there was no humans left on the planet, in about a century, the planet would recover. The ozone layer would close up. There would be plants. There would be another intelligent species that would come through. Humanity wouldn't be missed at all, because in the overall grand scheme of things, we, you know, are not that important. There was a cartoon on Tumblr, oddly enough, that I saw with Mother Nature, and there was a pagan practitioner who was apologizing to Mother Nature for all the screw-ups that humanity was doing and working real hard to minimize those screw-ups, and was, you know, really upset about this. And Mother Nature held this child and said, oh, you dear sweet thing, if you all died tomorrow, I wouldn't even notice, because in a century it would be all gone and I would recover completely. You're not killing me. You're changing things for you. You are killing you. And I went, whoa. Because that really puts it in perspective.
Wasn't that based on... Wasn't it Oberon Zell Ravenheart who originally wrote that metaphor as part of some essay or other?
I don't know. I know he did the Other People essay. And that it was the Christian mindset, and, you know, oh no, you're, God is going to destroy you because you're not paying attention to him. And it's like, we don't even, God, your God doesn't exist for me, because we're from the other people, the ones that were cast out, you know, and stuff like that. I know that one. I don't know. He may have done that one with nature. I don't know. It'd be interesting to look up.
Hmm.
But it was like, wow, because it really does put it in perspective, because whoever wrote it is right. I mean, 100,000 years,
I mean,
the planet would keep spinning.
It's very, very true. I mean, our species has not been around that long. You know, it isn't going to last forever. It's going to be like any other species on Earth. At some point, it'll go extinct. And, I mean, it becomes a big issue of deciding that one tiny party of people is right because, you know, they've got some perspective or other on how things are. And, you know, it in the long run, I mean, it just becomes an illusion. Mm-hmm. You know, it's the myth of supremacy, and then nature comes along and kicks your ass, and suddenly it's, maybe I wasn't right.
Yeah, and it's humbling when you actually stop and realize that. I mean, because then it puts it into real perspective. You know, what are... Religions are developed by people. by humans to explain life and what comes after death and to help people get comfortable with it, okay? Well, when you actually realize that, okay, my actions have consequences and affect other people around me, and maybe in 1,000 years, 1,000,000 years, it's going to change the planet, but it's not going to affect it to that point. You have to stop and realize that about the only thing that you're here to do is to take care of yourself and to please yourself and to make yourself the best life that you possibly can. Now, the dogs are going to go crazy here, so I'm just going to sit. You done barking? Okay. Good. All right, so let's see. There's been some people that have talked about a celestial dragon. Once again, I think that's, hell, the myths of the dragons themselves have the celestial dragon in it. The idea is that there's this spirit who is obviously dragon-shaped, who has been part of existence since the dawn of time. Creator of the universe, creator of the planets, first dragon. And when you stop and think about it, it's not that different from what humanity believes with all of our religions and everything like that. That there's an intelligence that encompasses everything and that we are all part of. They get into details of various things, that he's out there swimming through the cosmos, that he's eating planets, that if you're a bad dragon, he'll come and eat you too. And it's like, okay, whatever. That's details. And that's something that, you know, you can ignore or not, however you choose. There's a few other notes here. Let's see. We talked about the dragon powers. We talked about deities and dragons. One thing that I find personally offensive at times, especially when I'm watching movies like Aragon, is the thought of the sacrificial dragon. Okay, the story of Aragon is that in the past there were dragon riders. They were basically the police force in the military, and these dragon riders were wiped out by one that got greedy, and he turned on all the rest of the dragon riders because he was a very big asshole, and decided that he was going to take over. So there's no dragons except for one on the planet, and a dragon egg that is actually just a rock is stolen from this king, and it hatches with this boy named Aragon, who becomes the next dragon rider. So now we have two dragon riders on the entire planet. One's the king, who's very, very evil, and one's this boy, who's very, very good. Here's the problem. With two dragon riders on the planet, that means there's two living dragons, okay? The king's dragon and Aragon's dragon. During the course of the movie, what winds up happening is the dragon sacrifices herself over and over and over to ensure that the human lives, okay? And that's where I go bullshit and just really, really get personally offended. The idea that you can be a working partner with a dragon and both of you can fight towards a common goal is wonderful and fantastic. And if there is a reason to, yes, dragons will lay down their lives for you. However, in a situation like that where there's two dragons on the planet, I would not expect the dragon to lay down my life for me for any reason whatsoever, because the species is going to die out without this dragon, okay? And if the species dies out, something has been lost. You know, extinction sucks, and it really sucks hard. But doing it that way, you know, it's humanocentric again. Humans, well, of course a dragon's going to lay down its life for me. Bullshit. There's absolutely no compelling reason for a dragon to do that, because there's always more humans. There's always more, you know, people to come and bother. Dragonheart does the same thing. The Sean Connery, where he was the dragon, he pulls out half of his heart and gives it to a human who's sick. Same thing. Rhiannon's given me information on what on Aragorn, because she's actually read the books and I haven't. I've just seen the movie, and I've got to admit the movie does suck big time, according to what a lot of people have said. But, you know, here's from a species look, you've got 70 dragons in existence and you've got 7 billion humans. There's absolutely no reason for a dragon to sacrifice himself for the human. I mean, none. Let's see. We were talking...
But humans are so important.
Yeah, I know. Humans are the most important thing to humans. Everybody else, it's like, oh, it's a human.
Amazing how that is. Well, they're probably important to mosquitoes to a degree as well.
Well, mosquitoes are endangered species, you know, so... at least according to some of the aliens. For those of you that didn't get that, it's a reference to Lilo and Stitch. The planet was saved because somebody convinced the aliens that mosquitoes were an endangered species, and therefore the planet couldn't be wiped out. Anyway, you know, so that is my personal offense, is that all the stories that we have of dragons taking care of humans and sacrificing themselves for humans and everything like that, while it's nice and while it's romantic and while it's comforting to us, the reality is that we would be seen as a pet, and I often am seen as a pet. And the only reason that somebody or a dragon would go out of their way to help a human is because there was something in it for them. Okay, and I think I finally...
It's funny, because I think it occurs to me that whole, like, sacrificing dragon thing seems to be within the past maybe 20 years, whereas you look at older stories, I mean, even Dragon Slayer or, I want to say... Neverending Story, etc. The dragons never actually sacrifice themselves for the benefit of a human. Mm-hmm. Like, you go into the mythology and stuff, and there's no chance a dragon's gonna go, oh, right, poor pitiful human, let me sacrifice myself for your well-being.
Yeah. And it is, I mean...
But I think part of that is... I think it's partly because there's just this need to have a kinder, gentler culture where, you know, dragons are buddies and, you know, they don't actually do mean things because no monsters are mean.
Well, having lived this experience, having lived actually Hiccup's existence in a lot of ways, I can say that dragons are extremely powerful. They are wonderful allies. They are hellacious fighters, and I would partner with some of the dragons that I know in a heartbeat, but I wouldn't trust them to keep me alive if there was something that they had to do that was more important, okay? They are selfish. They are very much self-contained. they are not assholes about it. It's not like they walk up and slap you and say, I wouldn't sacrifice myself for you. It's more along the lines of, we have this common goal, and we're going to work together towards this common goal. If you fall on the way to get to this common goal, I'm going to leave you behind, because the goal is more important than you are. And, you know, if you think about it, that's the way military is. That's the way the police forces are. They'll come back once they've achieved whatever the thing was that they had you along with. But if you're dead, you're dead, you know. Because they're Darwinistic about their own species, they're also really Darwinistic about everything else around them. You know, if you die, you die. Must have been your time. And they're not going to mourn about that. They will, you know, if you're a good partner, if you're somebody that they like, if you're entertaining, if you have a special meaning to them, yeah, they'll try to help you, you know, but they're not going to sacrifice what they want for you. And you always have to keep that in mind. Now, you were saying?
Nothing.
Okay.
Sorry. I think I might have been thinking out loud while I was texting someone.
Yeah. Well, you said exactly, and I thought, and it sounded like you wanted to extend that a little bit. But anyway, thoughts on coexistence. That's one of the notes that I have here. Mostly, stay out of their way. I mean, Darwinistic and going to get what they want over centuries. They don't care who they roll over. If you happen to be standing there, you're going to be one of the squishies. And, you know,
well, considering that human lifetimes are so short, mm-hmm. in comparison, I mean, it does make sense. I mean, think of the way people treat, like, small critters or bugs. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, you're in the way, you're touching my food, etc.
I'm going to kill
Bam,
you.
Bam,
yeah.
You're gone.
Exactly. I mean, you know, it's very much like that. When dealing with dragons, understand that you are less than, okay, that you are very much less than them, and you disappearing would not affect them at all. You know, just like if you know, the way you treat insects is the way dragons are going to treat you. Okay. I get, while I've been doing all of this with the dragons and working with the dragons, I've always kept it very firmly in mind that, you know, I am much less than them. They all think that I'm less than them. And I try really, really, really hard not to pump that up at all. Okay. Things have happened. Rewards have been given. And yes, I've been promoted from mosquito to honeybee. Essentially, I am not simply a nuisance, but I'm actually useful for something. Therefore, they will give enough attention to me as a specific individual that I've got a little bit of leeway, okay? A little bit. And I'm a useful nuisance. So, keeping that in mind, you know, you always keep that in mind. That's where I'm at, and that's probably about as far as I'm going to be able to get. But understand that, yes, the overall, dragons are souls just like you and I are. They are souls that have a body just like us. They have their own existence and their own ideas and their own thoughts and feelings and wants where they live at. For various reasons, they interact with us, they like watching us, but I have a feeling that it's like going to the zoo and watching the monkeys. You know, it's, oh, look, they're being cute again. And that's about it. I don't know, that's pretty much everything. The lady who got in touch with us and wanted to hear more about the dragons, she wasn't really specific. I think she was asking about my actual direct work with them. And this is what most of the show has been. And this is as best as I can describe it. I'm not going to go into details on some of the things that happened because, frankly, some of it I can't believe happened to me in the first place. And it would start sounding like, you know, oh, yeah, I'm big, powerful, greatest thing ever. And I'm not. You know, I'm one of millions out there. And, I mean, if you think about it, there's 7 billion people on the planet. Even if 0.0001% of the people can get to the astral plane and interact on the astral plane consciously, you're talking about several hundred million people. And that's, you know, a significant amount. So don't think that this is fun. It's life. It's what is. It's what happens. It's a job like anything else.
Well, and I think, I mean, as you do spiritual work of whatever type draws you, and as you develop individually and progress on your path, different focuses come to mind. I mean, they become prevalent and important to you. So while, for instance, Joy's path, you know, involves dragons, I mean, mine doesn't. I, like, you know, I can discuss dragons from, you know, the mythological, you know, cultural perspective, but I don't work with them because generally my practice involves herbalism and, you know, some things like that, you know, don't involve dragons. So I've not been able to participate very much in this show, aside from making comments here and there. But each of us has a path to follow, and, you know, if dragons appear to you or they connect with you and want you to work with them, then by all means do that.
There's nothing wrong with it. I mean, I'm making it sound like either that they're just real assholes or that they're, you know, not worth your time. It's really not that. It's that you got to decide what you want in your practice. Me, I work with beings on the astral plane all the time, so yes, I was running into dragons regularly. Some of them have agreed to do a few things because they had, you know, an interest in what I was asking them to do that coincided with mine. And, you know, so that was fun, and that, you know, led to other interactions that were good. It can be rewarding, just like any interaction with any spirit can be, but you really do have to decide what you choose to do. Don't let anybody else decide on for you, because once that starts happening, then it's no longer your life, it's somebody else's life. I mean, I'm trying to think here of what else. There's a lot more details that I could give you about various things. Some of it is really irrelevant. Some of it is, it sounds like self-promotion. And I don't want it to start sounding like I'm, you know, greater than anyone else, because I'm not. I'm just another person who's had different experiences. It is possible to get a dragon companion, someone that will be with you for quite a long time. One of the things that it is possible to do and that I've run into a couple of times is the concept of a dragon essentially saying, you're the human for me.
You're just like the pet I've always wanted.
Yeah, pretty much. A lot of dragons think of it that way. It's you're a good kitty, and I'm going to adopt you. A lot more will see it as a way of having a minion. You know, the little yellow guys running around with what's his face? Well, Gru, there you go. You're one of the little yellow guys. Or, you know, something about that. There's some kind of connect there where it's like a dragon finds a human and goes, oh, I've been looking for you. You're mine. And I'm taking you home to mommy. And you become associated with them and you're interacting with them very, very regularly. It's a lot more common than some people think it is. And it can get out of hand really fast. As long as you understand that they still consider you to be less than them, unless they're really, really strange. But they also see you as a partner, at least for this time period. Somebody, you know, you have your own wants and desires, and they do see you, you know, as not necessarily a pet, but as an extension of their will. I have been privileged to have this happen to me. It's disconcerting, and it certainly readjusts your thinking. You stop being quite as arrogant when you start realizing that there's this other thing that literally can rip you to shreds if they choose to. You know, and shamanistic mindset may be that you die several times on the astral plane and you always get reborn better. It's still inconvenient and it still hurts a lot. So, let's see. But Dragon Society is literally a society. I mean, they have their own interactions, they have their own cliques, they have their own groups. Some are wiser than others. Some are more intelligent than others. Others are really, really stupid. Others are very limited in what they think about. For instance, there was another...
Dragons are people.
Well, pretty much. And that's, you know, if you take nothing else away from this show, anything on the astral plane is a person. Anything that thinks... can reason, has emotions, can empathize, and has a form of some sort, is a person. You know, even though there's many beings on there that would, you know, really object to what I'm saying, it's a consciousness. It's its own intelligence, and you have to treat it as such. You have to be open to them wanting what they want, and... you're a tool to get it for them, or whatever. You know, so if you have, you know, assholes here in the physical world that you know, you're going to have assholes on the astral plane. I mean, it's the same thing. Trying to think of anything
this
else.
This is
I
true.
Can, trying to think of anything else I can talk about. I think.
We kind of, like, I don't know. I mean, we say 2 hours as a general sort of guideline, but, I mean, I think some shows are going to be shorter and some are just going to be longer by nature. Mm-hmm. So, I mean...
Yeah, we say 2 hours
if it happens
all the riffing. To do all the
riffing.
It's true.
Yeah. Because it does... We do tend to do that. So, I mean, if you have heard any of our previous shows... you know perfectly well that we will go off on tangents and talk forever on things and try to bring them back to the main theme. So
that's why everything relates back to tarot.
Absolutely.
I mean, I don't know. I'm very happy with my interactions with them. I've got several that look to me for guidance and for help. I've had a working relationship with two dragons. In fact, it turns out, remember the story with of Merlin and him having the vision of the two dragons fighting in the cavern underneath the land and knocking the castles down? Remember that?
Yes.
Okay. I actually know the two dragons that were doing that. I've met them.
Nice.
And they're not assholes. I got their side of the story of it. And it's actually a pair that are getting married in the next 400 years or so and going to have kids. But they were best friends back then, and they, you know, sparred with each other. And they knew what was going on. They knew that the castle was up there. They would fight and try to knock the castle down. One of them became the Dragon of Wales. His name is Finn, for Finn McCool. And the other is a half cat spirit, half dragon spirit. Because Bast apparently jumped her father in his dragon form and had a kid, her. So it gets kind of confusing after a little while. So yeah, they were knocking
undoubtedly
down. They were knocking down the castles on purpose because they wanted to see how long it would take. And when Merlin showed up, they, you know, were like, okay, well, we'll stop so that you don't get killed, you know. Darn it. And they stopped. So that's their side of the story. It was kind of funny, actually. Because when she first told me this, I'm like, no, no. Because she was describing this. She was in a cavern underneath the ground fighting with Finn. And they were having a fun time. And they're fighting, you know, knocked the castle down. And I'm like, this is starting to sound hauntingly familiar. And then this boy showed up and asked me to stop doing it. And I'm like, no. No, 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 no. I'm like, you're telling me that you were the two dragons that were doing that in the story of Merlin? She's like, yeah. Oh, and you're never going to get a dragon's real name. If you discover a dragon's real name, you've got a lot of pull. They're never going to give it to you. You're either going to name the dragon or they're going to give you a name that you can associate with them. Let's see.
Well, that lines up quite well with any general occultist or indigenous culture as well, because I mean the idea of having a being's true name means that you have power over it, and mm-hmm. I mean there are cultures in the world where a person's given not just the name that they're initiated with, you know, in a rite of passage or a spiritual initiation or whatever, but a secret name that, you know, is the name by which they are known to their deity or spirit or what have you.
Yeah, exactly.
So, you know.
Yeah, and
I mean,
that's, you know. Go ahead.
Sorry, I was just thinking that that's kind of something that I guess you kind of encounter as you work in different traditions,
yeah,
because
I wrote an article about names and true names. I don't think that it's quite as devastating as it's made out to be in some groups. There is definitely power in the name. But that's because it throws you into a specific mindset. Quiet, Jack. For instance, if I'm called Davin, that puts me into a very male priest mindset. If I'm called Joy, I'm in a very female of this world, lover, wife, mother mindset. If I'm called Ace, that puts me into another mindset. So the name has the power in that it puts you into a certain attitude and a certain mental and spiritual place when that name is used to you. Okay? It's not that you can call me, who knows, and you can make me do whatever you want. It's that you have enough empathy that you can use that name to manipulate my choices.
It's true. Yeah, I mean, and there's a lot of books. I mean, if someone's interested in learning more about the concept of magical names or of, you know, the sort of significance of names, I mean, you can look into books by pagan authors, and you can look into books by Samael Anvayor, which talk about the sort of significance or power behind them from different perspectives. Because in Samael Anvayor's tradition, he's a Gnostic author, or was, but he talks about that being your sort of higher self name, which isn't necessarily giving power over you. It's simply the name of your true essence. There's a lot of pagan authors who will kind of put the fear of, you know, curses and stuff into you, especially in some of the sort of Wicca 101 type books.
Yeah.
Where they'll say, you know, beware of giving your magical name to anyone because suddenly they'll have power over you and they'll curse you or they'll control you or whatever. And it's like, well, at the same time, I mean, it just could be a name that appeals to you as the persona you wear in ritual.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it doesn't necessarily have any power beyond what you give it.
And you can take on different names. I mean, when I've talked about being transgender and the fact that I'm going from male to female, I mean, everybody knew Davin. Davin was the guy that had a hell of a website who commented on lots of boards and things like that. Okay. A lot of people knew who Davin was. When I came out as transgender and changed over to female, Davin is still there, and Davin still exists, and Davin is still an aspect of me. But because I was changing so much of my life all at once, I went through another dedication ceremony and took on the name Aaron, and it means just as much to me as Davin ever did. That's why it's now called Aaron's Journal instead of Davin's Journal. It's the same website. I still have the same thoughts and the same ideas. It's just now I'm doing it with a more female aspect than I do with a male. And so, yeah, you can change it and have a lot of the same associations. But if you go up to somebody on the street at Heartland and say, "Do you know who Aaron is?" They'll probably say, "Yeah," and point to like 20 other people. But if you go up to one of them and probably say, "Have you ever been to Davin's Journal?" I'll bet you money that at least 10% of them have been there at some point. You know, and that's not arrogance. I've got over 500,000 hits, unique hits, on my website. So, anyway. Not arrogance at all.
No. I'm going to do it. I'm going to ask random people.
Okay. You know, so that's, you know, another aspect of it. So we got off the track. We're on names now, dragons. That's pretty much it. I mean, we've got some I've got a couple of thoughts on things that we can do, like an herbalism show. But so that, you know.
We definitely could.
Yeah, so that whatever his name is on the other end here, Brian, can actually participate once. Share his knowledge instead of it just being the Aaron show.
It's true. Well, and I mean, like, it's I suppose it's been kind of difficult as well because I've been kind of waffling on what my spiritual path really is lately because I'm kind of fascinated by Gnosticism, but I'm kind of still drawn to Druidry and stuff, so I kind of go back and forth. So it, like, from day to day even, I'm like, I am so Gnostic today. And then, you know, by the end of the same day, I'll be like, I am so druidic. I really am.
Why choose?
So, yeah, I mean...
You can make a blended
well,
practice.
That's the thing. Well, and the reality is, too, I mean, the more I know about both of those paths, the more I realize that they overlap significantly anyway. So it really isn't, like, a contradictory thing. And I don't know. It's kind of funny because I find myself kind of wearing various symbols, and then people are like, oh, you're... You know, in one case, I wear a so-called Star of David, and people are like, wait, you're Jewish? And I'm like, well, no. I mean, I could give you 12 different religions that, you know, talk about the same symbol and the significance of it there, and, you know, so on and so forth. So, I mean, I wear different symbols. I wear a crucifix from time to time because it amuses me. And people assume that I'm, you know, Catholic or Christian or whatever, and I'm like, well, I'm not really that either. I don't want to go into a long-winded explanation of it for you, but no. Et cetera, et cetera. So, I mean, I waffle around with symbols and stuff, and people are like, hey, you're such and such an association they're familiar with. And I'm like, no, I'm not. So, well, yeah, I mean...
My point is that... You are what you are. If you're a Gnostic Druid or a Druidic Gnostic, you know, that's completely up to you. I mean, hell, I'm a Wiccan Druid witch, so, you know, who works with dragons. So, and that's not a contradiction in my own head. The only place that it becomes a contradiction is when I'm teaching it to others. Because then I have to put myself into one mindset so that I'm giving the pure tradition to them and not confusing it with a lot of other things.
Well, and that's the thing, too, because, I mean, people, they want to sort of narrowly define you so that they can keep track of where you're coming from. And it's like, well, no, because I can switch all over the place here and there.
Right back to labeling.
But I think part of... Well, exactly, and I think part of that is just because a lot of people, when they're new to various spiritualities, aren't familiar with all the connections between them. So they feel that by narrowly labeling you, it somehow gives them a grasp of what's going on, whereas, you know, you can, you know, go from the perspective of someone who practices yoga and, you know, for some people... The idea of a druid yogi or, you know, a Gnostic yogi or whatever is a weird contradiction because they assume that yoga specifically is Hindu. Some people just assume that yoga is non-denominational or whatever. And, you know, they don't really understand what the significance is to those and what the common bond is between them.
Right. And they also... at least some of the social justice warriors are screaming about cultural appropriation. But my opinion is that as long as you're respectful to the culture that it's coming from and realizing that it is a deep part of their culture and doing your best to honor and acknowledge all of that, then there shouldn't be a problem with it. It's when you get somebody that has no idea what Native American life is, how the Native Americans have been related to over time, no idea what the individual tribes believe, and starts teaching how to be a medicine man, that you run into those types of problems.
Well, and I kind of, I mean, I'm inclined to look back at, you know, cultures in the classical world where those hard sort of distinctions never existed because they didn't have to. Like, you could be publicly practicing, you know, the city's religion, but privately be a Christian or a Gnostic or a, you know, a devotee of Dionysus or whatever. And that wouldn't be seen as a problem because, you know, your personal worship or, you know, spiritual life was just that. It was yours. Mm-hmm. And if you went to the temple and communed with the Vestal Virgins or whatever, then, you know, that would be completely normal and acceptable. And I think these days there's this desperate need to draw those hard lines between different groups, and it becomes this kind of backwards notion of just limited thinking that shows no understanding of the way the classical world worked.
Separation instead of inclusion.
Exactly.
Anyway, so and I think okay. So that
we
don't we
could go on forever
to hour three. That's the show. I hope you enjoyed it. Listen, since we don't have anything really lined up for other shows, if you have suggestions, please email us, joy@magicalmusings.net or brian@magicalmusings.net. We're on Tumblr, wide-worlds-joy.tumblr.com and cosmic-rebirth.tumblr.com is Brian's. Get in touch with us. Give us ideas. Tell us what you would like to hear us talk about. If we're not covering an aspect of something that you would find interesting to find out about, hit us up on email. We'll talk about it and see if we can do a show out of it. You know?
I have three ideas for the next 3 months that come to mind as ideas for shows. October being what it is, I'm thinking we do a Samhain themed show, or we, you know, I think Samhain is probably the primary thought that comes to mind. And November comes, and then you guys call it Veterans Day, don't you? November 11th?
I believe so.
Or is that a totally different thing? We up here and in Britain, they call it Remembrance Day, but basically it's the same idea. Mm. And I was thinking maybe we could talk about, I don't know, ancestors or heroes or something along that line.
We could definitely do something like that. I'd rather not do another Samhain show because we already did a Samhain show. And if they want to know...
Did we?
Yeah.
It's so long.
Yeah, it has been, hasn't it? It's already up on the website. If they want to read about it or hear about it, all they need to do is go and listen to it, because we covered pretty much everything about Samhain that I can think of to cover in a show.
Then
like
maybe... What if, since we have like a month to sort things out, maybe we can find someone to talk about...
Ooh,
some other tradition that celebrates a thinking, like something related to that, voodoo or I don't know, something.
We can definitely do that, but
I think we should end the recording for the show now. Like I don't really have anything, because I'm thinking another sort of. Trying to think of something else that might be Yule related, but then I kind of want to examine maybe, I don't know, comparative religions or astrotheology or something related to the winter solstice from a different perspective than just kind of a broad blanket approach that, like we did last time.
Yeah. We could possibly get somebody here to talk about sigils and maybe chaos magic or something. I don't know. We'll figure it out. And yes,
indeed.
Send us your ideas and thoughts. And if you know somebody that happens to be an expert on a certain topic that you'd like to hear more about, you know, send us their name too. And we'll talk to them and see what we can work out. But until next
Zach.
Show.
Yes, thank you for joining us. We'll get back with you next month. So have a good time.
Take care, everyone.